Only one mind for my country. Through the gray waters of amnesia, he drifted, coming back from blind coma. First the echoes, like electronically amplified voices, speaking from a deep, deep well, then far off the dim, pink molecules of light. David's body lay still in the military hospital bed. Only his eyes rolled beneath the idols. For several hours he lay that way, perfectly still, just fluttering. The fluttering became more intense, then his eyes opened. "When I woke up," David said, "I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't remember how I'd gotten there or why I was in the hospital." He asked nurses and aides why he was there. They told him he'd have to ask his doctor. When David finally saw him, the doctor said, "You tried to commit suicide." That came as a great surprise to David. He didn't think he was the suicidal type. He asked the doctor how he tried to commit suicide. "You took an overdose of sleepies," the doctor told him. David knew that sleepies was a patent medicine, that it was related chemically to an antihistamine, and that it could produce drowsiness. But David also knew that it was not nearly as dangerous as a perception sleeping pill. Although he began to sense that something was fishy, he did not challenge the doctor, nor did he let on that he suspected the story to be untrue. For the next several days, he simply lay in the hospital bed puzzling over the odd chain of events that had landed him there. I interviewed David several times over a period of 2 years. Each interview produced additional information as David's memory returned in fragmented, isolated bursts. The following is taken from thousands of pages of transcript and has been edited so that the tedious process that uncovered David's memories is absent. It is slightly misleading, only that David did not remember his story in one continuous sequence, nor did the other victims quoted in this book. David had joined the U.S. Air Force in 1969. During his high school years, the draft had still been in effect, and after graduating on the community college level, he decided to get as much education as he could before his name was inevitably called by Selective Service. As his induction date approached, David realized he could obtain a deferral from the draft because of his high school scholastic standing, but he decided instead to take a break from education and fulfill his military obligation as profitably as he could. Although he questioned America's reasons for fighting, he did feel the military service was his duty. David had not been part of the 60s, quote, revolution. He had never smoked marijuana, nor had taken LSD, nor had demonstrated against the war in Vietnam, like so many of his friends. He was a studious, intelligent young man who was not inclined to rebellion. Friends and family describe him as one possessed of unusual common sense. In keeping with his cautious and practical nature, he negotiated a contract for a medical corps service with his local Air Force recruiter, thinking this would help him fulfill his ambition to become a doctor. After an uneventful in-processing, David was sent to Laclede Air Force Base for the usual 6 weeks basic training, and then on to a technical school for another 6 weeks of special training. But when that time came for his job assignment, to his greater disappointment, he was assigned to the Supply Corps rather than the Medical Corps. He felt betrayed by the Air Force, and immediately after receiving his AFSC job assignment number, he retired to his barracks to rehearse a protest to his commanding officer. Moments later, a non-uniformed man entered the empty barracks and asked him to step aside and take a walk. David was puzzled but went along without comment. When the two had reached a quiet spot on the base, the man told David that he guessed he was disappointed about receiving the AFSC of, quote, box pusher in a supply warehouse. David was surprised by a man's knowledge of his situation. Before he could reply, the man told David that the AFSC was just a cover, that he actually had been chosen to work in a sensitive area of intelligence. The assignment sounded glamorous to David and lifted his sagging spirits. He immediately decided to go along with the change of plans and accept the special assignment without protest. The unidentified man told David to be patient and to learn well the special techniques of computer programming he would be trained in while waiting for his security investigation to be completed. Within a few weeks, David was issued a top-secret crypto security clearance and assigned to the air base at Minot, North Dakota. At Minot, he continued to feed supply numbers into a computer, developing his already excellent memory. He did his job well, and soon he received a letter of commendation and was promoted to sergeant. But for all his accomplishments, he had begun to grow restless. Although he knew his computer program was just a cover for intelligence work, he was still not satisfied with his Air Force life. I was beginning to not like the extreme regimentation, and I suppose inside myself I was beginning to build up a resentment about being there. But after I woke up in the hospital, I was not resentful. I was passive. I lay there thinking, trying to recall the last memories I had before I woke up in that bed. I didn't remember anything. It was like I'd been asleep for my entire life up to that point. Like I was Rip Van Winkle. The memories of what had happened I did recover over a period of time, but they were fuzzy at first. It seemed like somebody was violating me, raping my mind. I was strapped down in the bed. I was yelling and screaming about something. I'm not the type of person that cusses that much. I hardly ever use foul language, but I know that I said some pretty foul things to those men who were with me. They were officers, and in the service you can't call a superior officer an obscene name without getting punished. Yet I don't ever think I was ever reprimanded. One guy would ask me questions in an accusatory manner. Another guy would come over and say comforting things. The first guy would come back and accuse me again. Then the second guy would come in, pat my arm, and be friendly. I could remember their faces and their tone of voice, but I couldn't remember the content of what they were talking about. David thought about his situation. Suppose he tried to commit suicide. He probably would have been kicked out of the service. At best, he might be given a medical discharge, so he began to prepare himself for that eventually. He wouldn't mind getting out of the service under circumstances, even with a psychological discharge. It didn't happen. Instead, David was visited by men in civilian clothes who told him that he'd been chosen for a special intelligence assignment. They said the details of this assignment could not be revealed until the proper time, and then would not be allowed to talk to anybody about it. They soon said he would be receiving his orders quickly. I'd expected at least to have some stripes taken away for the suicide attempt. Instead, 5 different sets of orders came down. They were all type military orders, regular orders, but they had been given to 5 different places at once. It was impossible. I took the orders to headquarters and told them that somebody had goofed. It was plain to see that somebody had screwed up. The way the military runs, it was not unusual. No one gets excited about it. The guys in the office said that they would straighten it out. Then I was told that I had 2 weeks' leave coming. They ordered me home to wait while they got my order straightened out. Happy to get a break after 18 continuous months of military life without leave, David went home. I was hoping they'd forget all about me. I was praying this time the computer would have completely lose me. The first evening at home, something compelled David to break security. Alone with his mother, he told her that he had not really attempted suicide. I suppose that my first duty was to my family, and my second duty was to my country. After I discharged my moral duty to my mother, I was free to obey my government's wish and not remember anything about it. That's probably how it worked, in spite of their programming. After David had been at home for the full 2 weeks, and was just beginning to think about maybe the computer had lost him after all, a telegram came. There were no written orders, no official seals, just a Western Union telegram ordering him to report to a base in Northern California, and from there to embark to the Far East and overseas duty. There were numbers on the face of the telegram, but at the time David gave them no special notice. These numbers may have been an assignment authorization, for seldom are servicemen sent overseas on the strength of a telegram alone. When I got to the base in California, I showed them the telegram and the air police hustled me to another airplane and flew me to Guam. On the plane to Guam, David ran into an airman he'd known as Minot. The airman's name was Max. Like David, Max had been attached to the supply wing at Minot, but he had been in a different type of supply operation. And all the time they were together in Guam, David never learned that the details of Max's assignment. Both of them were supposed to be a supplyman, but David thought Max had some pretty unusual qualifications for supplyman. For instance, he held a fifth-degree black belt in karate. Max and I had checked into the barracks when we got there, but after preliminaries, we were put on a bus and taken to an isolated place 8 miles outside the base. There were six L-shaped barracks set up inside a high electrified fence with barbed wire at the top. Inside the compound, there was a movie theater, a store, a barbershop, a chow hall, and a recreation center. There were several hundred guys living in that compound. We could leave anytime we wanted. All we had to do was show the proper credentials to the air police at the gate. The compound seemed to be regular Air Force. The place was called Marlborough. And as far as I could tell, there were guys there who had all sorts of different functions in the Air Force, but nobody really discussed their jobs. Several of the guys at Marlborough had been in the supply wing in North Dakota, but at Marlborough, there was working on other areas. In other words, guys who'd been in the supply wing in North Dakota were in civilian engineers or the air police. One airman policeman in Guam, I remember, had been showing around boxes just like other supply men when he was in Minot. Suddenly, now he was an air policeman. I couldn't figure it out, and I wasn't about to ask questions. I guess we all assumed that we were all on special assignment, and I'm pretty sure that if I'd asked any way about it, they would have avoided an answer. I certainly would have if somebody had asked me. David may rank fast in the Air Force. He was a good airman, a good supply man, yet anybody he talked to about supply dues didn't know what he was talking about. His duties weren't like the others. My Air Force file shows that the first three digits of my AFSC are 647, A647, in some kind of box pusher. Yet I never pushed a box all the time I was in the Air Force. After the tour of duty, Max and David returned home together on the same plane. At the airport, Max was called over to the intercom and went off to answer the page. Two air police returned for his luggage, and David did not see Max until after he was separated from the service for some months. Then it was a strange meeting. Dave was walking down the streets of Disneyland, and his eye fell on Max walking toward him in the crowd. David was delighted to see his old buddy again, but Max was strangely distant. "He didn't seem very interested in our reunion," David said. "He shook hands with me, and I began to talk, but he seemed kind of passive. I wanted to sit down and tell him all the things that had happened to me since we last saw each other. But Max didn't want to talk. He cut me short, said goodbye, and left." That's something that always puzzled me. How can a guy who is with your constant companion for so many months, a guy who has fought for you and gotten to know you inside and out and not want to talk to you. How could that have just brushed me off like that? When I first got out of the service, all I could remember about my 4 years was that I had a lot of fun. I mean, all the pictures I have and all the recollections I had were of Max and Pat and I having fun, skin diving, laying on the beach, collecting shells, walking in the jungle. It never dawned on me until later that I must have done something while I was in the service. Pat was a young woman from the Midwest who was assigned to serve as David's secretary. Almost immediately when they met on Guam, they fell in love. Pat was something special. She was everything I would ever dreamed of in a woman. I suppose she felt that I was everything that she wanted in a man. It didn't take long for us to go to bed after we met, and from then on, throughout my tour of duty, Max, Pat, and I were inseparable. David was not talking about a menage a trois. Max was not attracted to Pat, nor she to him. They all held each other to be good friends, but David and Pat's feelings for each other were the strongest. David now thinks it's odd that the three of them got along so perfectly from the first moment they met. Max was David's kind of man, and Pat was David's kind of woman. In the years that have passed since he got out of the Air Force, David has come to believe that Max and Pat and he were matched up by a computer. We hit it off from the start. We had the same interests. We were nervous about the same things, and we would laugh at the same kind of jokes. We were three individuals who were very close, where one lacked a quality and another had something to fill the lack. The Air Force takes your psychological tests, the cumulative progress reports, which have been kept in just about every individual in the United States from the first grade through high school. These records have your IQ, your aptitude tests, and all the things they accumulated on you throughout your school years. They gave him a complete examination to determine your psychological profile and everything about your likes and dislikes. They feed selected information, any information they are looking to match up, into a computer and run yours with other people's until they have a psychological match. In spy books I've read, undercover agents sent to foreign countries are usually teamed with a spy of the opposite sex. Even if two people are both married and have families at home, the directors of intelligence usually send along someone who can take care of the natural human sexual needs of the other while risking a breach of security. That way, no horny agent is going to have an associate with a prostitute or someone who might turn out to be a double agent or a counter spy. I talk with other guys in the service and they talk about getting laid in Hong Kong or Japan or Korea. I didn't have to talk about anything. I didn't have to brag. I'd just smile at them, secure in my love for Pat. David said that there were several other women in the barracks who, like Pat, were secretaries but had security clearance. And as is the case with Pat, many of them also had close relationships with the men to whom they were assigned. 2 months before their tour of duty was to expire, David and Max were sent home. Pat stayed behind in Guam, but David and Pat arranged to meet once they were both out of the service. They exchanged home addresses, but somehow David lost hers, and he was strangely unable to remember her last name or even the town from which she came from. David never saw Pat again. Looking back at it, it looks like it was awfully convenient. Pat was a liberated woman. She knew exactly who she was, and that's just the kind of woman I like to have around. She fulfilled every need that I ever had, to such a degree that it's a problem now. I can't meet a girl that's as good as her. When you've begun in paradise, it's hard to find paradise again. You always want to go back. I think of her all the time, but I just can't remember her last name. It's a total blank. I just can't remember. During the entire 13-hour flight home, David had to debrief himself into a tape recorder while sitting between two air policemen. He doesn't remember what he talked about. No one was questioning him. He just talked. Upon his return, he was assigned to a base in California. Immediately reporting for duty, he found that he no longer had a security clearance. His job was to answer telephones on the base and to listen to complaints. He'd take calls from the wives of the Air Force personnel and relay their complaints to the proper channels. That's all he did during the entire last year of service. When it came time to get processed out, I wanted to get the medals I earned when I was stationed in Guam. They were actually theater ribbons. I had so many ribbons when I left Guam that the officer I reported to told me not to wear them because I would attract attention to myself. During the out processing, they thawed out my file. They do that regularly every year, you know. They show your records and have you go over them and make sure that they're correct. Then you sign a paper that states you've approved the records. The last time I was shown my records, they'd been changed. Instead, all of the typed dogger reports were in my file before, but there was a clean computer printout. I asked the officer in charge who had happened to the notice of my being awarded those theater ribbons. He told me that since I had such a high security clearance, some of the things that were in my files made it necessary to expunge a lot of the information from the record. He said that there was a top secret file on me that was available to people who had the right clearances. The file had me approve was the one which had been shown to anyone who did not have the highest clearances. He said that because this was more or less a public record, it cannot have anything on it in a sensitive nature. It was very misleading, that report. It looked like I had been a supply man, a box pusher, and I'd done nothing else except try to attempt suicide. The phony hospital story was in this report, so deniability was built in. Then I went through the normal out process and went home. All I can say is that everybody, my folks, my friends, everyone who'd known me before, noticed how changed I was. I was fearful and under tight control. David decided that he would first reorient himself to the civilian pace of life and then look for a job. But when he began to look for employment, he suddenly realized that he had some deep psychological problems. At his first job interview, he was routinely asked to fill out the company's job application form. He sat down at a desk and started writing. He wrote his name and noticed that his hands were sweating. As he began to enter his address, his heart began pounding so loudly it was audible. He became short of breath and felt like the walls were closing in on him. He fought to remain calm, but within a few moments, he snatched up the form and bolted out the door. That evening, he discussed the strange physical effects that had come over him with his parents. They assured him he was probably just very anxious about getting the job. The next day, he went on another interview. Again, he was asked to fill out a job application. This time, he got further into filling out the form. He put down his name, address, date of birth, social security number, health information. But when he came to the place in the form which required work information about the past 4 years, the pounding in his ears, the shortness of breath, and the terrifying feeling of being confined in a small place came over him again, and he was left the building with a form wadded up in his hand. Over the next few months, David applied for many jobs. The results were always the same. He could not overcome the terror that gripped him wherever he went and anybody who asked him information about he spent the last 4 years. David's parents suggested that he try to get a job working with computers and take advantage of the training the Air Force had given him. The mere mention of computers made him fly into a rage. I still couldn't face whatever it was that they were blocking me. To this day, I can't stand the thought of a computer. I'd like to smash them all up. I realize, of course, that is irrational. David remained hopeful that whatever was causing his anxiety would pass with time. Meanwhile, he decided to go back to college. He had no trouble getting into a major university since his high school and community college grades were high and no one asked him for details of his service years. But during his first semester, he encountered the same blocks that had kept him from getting a job. In my psychology course, you had to get up in front of a circle of people and talk. You had to bare your soul. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't stand up and be calm and let people question me. They were all harmless questions, but I'd get the pounding heart and sweaty palms, the shortness of breath, and the feeling of claustrophobia again. I'd just clam up and leave the room. It was then that David understood that he could no longer face the problem by himself. He sought out a psychiatrist who'd been recommended by a friend. The first psychiatrist I went to was a male. He had used hypnotherapy with me, and he found me to be a very easy subject. I'd go into a trance at the drop of a hat, but whenever he tried to regress me, saying, "I want you to go back," I'd just bring myself out of a trance, even if it were in a deep trance. My heart would be pounding, my palms would be sweating, and I'd feel the same claustrophobia I'd felt whenever I'd confronted those application forms. David found that he was much more relaxed with his second psychiatrist, a woman named Alice. Alice, also more successful in hypnotherapy, David would go into a trance quickly and deeply, yet whenever Alice tried to regress him to Air Force periods, he would bring himself out of the trance as he'd done previously. But she found that by regressing David to his childhood and approaching the Air Force period from earlier years, remembering was less difficult for him. At first, she tried to have me relax. She talked in a very soothing voice, telling me to close my eyes. I felt like I was surrendering to her. It was easy to get me into a light trance. I laid down my defenses and was going deeper and deeper. But as soon as she said, "Now we're going to go back," I sat straight up and was wide awake. Alice couldn't get over how fast I went under. One time she said she was just talking to me and her voice put me completely under when she wasn't even trying. I was highly suggestible. But whenever she'd say, "Let's go back," all the muscles in my neck would strain and it would grip the arms of the chair until my knuckles turned white. Once I was holding a piece of paper in my hand, and when I came out of hypnosis, the paper was completely soaked with sweat. Only a minute after she said, "We're going back," I was wide awake. Alice never did succeed completely with hypnosis, but something must have been released because of her attempts. As soon as we were able to get back into the usual talking technique of psychotherapy, I started talking about my childhood. I never thought much about it, I guess, but I couldn't remember much of my childhood. For instance, my grandfather had died when I was 14 and he lived with us. Everyone says he and I were really close, but I had no mental picture of him at all. That's when Alice started trying to get me to remember my childhood. I don't know if I remembered my childhood before I went into the service or not. It seemed like I did, because it wasn't a problem to this day. Still, I can't remember much everything before the age of 10 is completely blank. Alice and I kept working. At first, the memories recovered were all painful memories. Alice thought this was the most unusual. Usually people remember the pleasurable things first. Then she tried to get me to remember only my painful experiences. And once I'd remembered a lot, she started trying to get me to remember the pleasurable ones. David and Alice continued to work with standard psychiatric techniques and with hypnosis. Finally, after 16 months, 3 sessions a week, Al had asked David to make a choice. "We probably can penetrate the blocks around your Air Force years and find out what they were planted and why, but it may take a long time. On the other hand, we can work on every other area and get you into function normally without anxiety reactions whenever anyone asks you about those years." Alice said, "Now you have to decide if you just want to function normally or you want to unravel the whole mystery and find out who did it, why it was done, and what they have hidden from your own mind." Since the therapy had nearly depleted his family savings, David knew what the answer must be. He told Alice he would be content to just function normally. After 2 more months of treatment, Alice and David had their first and last session. After 260 therapy sessions, Alice and I had 1 8-hour session which more or less recapped all the information we had collected. She told me that when I first came in, I talked into a monotone voice. I was very, very controlled. I showed no emotions and had no inflection in my speech. I talked to her for the first 3 months that way. She said there was a wall that she couldn't break down. Alice recommended that I continue working on my own and going to group therapy. I went to a couple of sessions, but when I got in front of a group, I became fearful again. It was more than just stage fright. It was a horrible feeling. I still have it when I get up in front of a group to be asked questions. Alice did not figure out what this was about. I am now beginning to, but figuring something out is one thing and actually overcoming it is another. Alice's expert guidance and her definite use of hypnotherapy was helpful. While he did not recover his memory at once, in time David began to remember isolated events. He is now able to reconstruct a picture of at least some of the things he did while hypnoservice to his country. "One day I had a vivid dream. Then it was like, little by little, memory cells exploding in my brain. I began to remember certain incidents. At first, I didn't know if these were still real memories or just dreams. Today, I still don't know if they are accurate or not, but they are so real in their details that I believe they are the truth." Naturally, when you've had amnesia, you're not really going to trust your memories at first. But if the memories settle in, If you can recall more and more detail about an event, you know that you're recalling a true event. The most vivid memory I have is about Vietnam. I was standing at a long table on a beach. There was North Vietnamese soldiers sitting on one side and American officers sitting on the other. Everyone was in uniform. Our men were from the Air Force, Navy, and Marines. The Marines had sidearms, and no one else had any weapons. What horrified me was that out in the harbor, offshore at some distance from the beach, was one of our battleships and another battleship or gunboat. I guess that it was Vietnam or Russian, but I'm not expert at naval craft identification. All I know, I was terrified because the big guns on the ships were trained not on each other, but on us. I guess they were prepared to blow us all up should anything go wrong on the beach, or should there be a double cross. We had our interpreters, who were Air Force men. They did translating, and our officers waited for the translations. The discussion was very heated, but for some reason I remember vividly nothing was being written down. That may have been the reason that I was standing there at one end of the table. I remember that they had been trying somewhere along the line to get me to have total recall. I can't remember the details or the progression of events. I know that I had memory training. At Marlborough, for some reason, I'd give up 3 hours earlier than anyone else and report to somewhere I can't remember and then go to work at 8:30. I remember riding the bus from Marlborough to the base in Guam, and I was the only one on the bus, but I can't remember where I went before I reported for regular duty. I suspect that the computer work wasn't part of the memory training, but I can't say that that's exactly what it was. There must have been more to it. I just don't remember the details, but I have the impression that I was used as a human tape recorder. I do know one thing about the beach scene. When I came back from overseas, only 3 days after I came back, it was announced that the North Vietnamese were going to give our prisoners of war back in an exchange. The meeting on the beach might have been an early parley about ending the war and exchanging prisoners. At least that's what strikes me as the best answer to the questions of what the meeting was about. I might have been a witness. I really don't understand why, or why the gunboats were pointing at us. I can't remember the date or anything that places the memory in time. The thing that really bothers me about this whole thing is that I sit there and talk to you, but I still can't sit down and say, okay, I joined the service on such and such a day, and this is what happened to me during a 4-year period in chronological order. Ever since I got out of the service, I haven't been able to give a day-by-day account of what happened to me during those 4 years. Some people might call what happened to me brainwashing. I've called it that, but it's not really brainwashing. I think of it as brainwashing as something brutal. I don't think I was treated brutally. Also, what happened to me was something that was much more sophisticated than what I have read about brainwashing. I believe I'm telling the truth, and I'd like to see someone disprove it. I only have these fragments of memory, so if I went to the Air Force, they'd pull out my folder and throw it on the desk and say, "See? There it is, in black and white. He's a nut. He tried to commit suicide by taking a patent medicine." I feel I was used. Why would they use an enlisted man that is supposed to be a supply man? Every squadron has supply personnel, so I guess it's a perfect cover. A supply man is so common he couldn't be noticed. How well it worked out for them from their point of view, I just don't know. But for mine, well, it didn't work out too well. All the doubts and fears I have now, years later, and after a lot of psychiatric help, which I paid for myself, made me an experiment. If it was one, a failure to me. I never thought about laying down my life, but maybe I laid down a lot more than my life in service to my country. My soul? 16 years later, David is still sleeping only 2 hours a night. He is still having nightmares, hearing voices, and seeing shadows. Otherwise, he functions normally. Yet many of his symptoms are identical with the symptoms of those psychiatrists call people with dissociative identity disorder. I hadn't talked to David in, 10 years? And now that I'd learned much more about the survivors of Operation Mind Control, I thought I'd check in to see how he was doing. I found him fascinated with tattoos. Every time I see a tattoo anywhere, on anyone, I'm drawn to it, David said. I've got to look at it. I want to find out if it's a butterfly, a rose, or something. And in 1994, we said the word together, Bluebird.